I've been looking forward to a chance to getting a chance rather to talk with Luke Grohman. He's the president founder of Forest for the Trees. And I'll tell you how to get a hold of that in just a second and follow him on YouTube. He does a great sort of 5 to 10 minute weekly YouTube broadcast that I find is essential listening. Why? Because he has a very broad understanding, and that's not quite the right words I'm looking for. It's an incredible understanding, but of the bigger pictures first. Make your decisions after you understand what's going on a macro level. Luke Grohman does that. He joins me now. Luke, thanks for finding time for us. I can tell you all of Canada has got a smile on their face. Looking forward to hearing from you.
Thanks for having me on, Michael. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm going to throw something at you that I said at the top of the show I'm struggling with. And that I think some of the things that are going on are so monumental, and maybe we've sensed it, by the way, with record gasoline prices. People might know, hey, there's something going on here. Or we're going to talk later about that incredible situation on the London Metals Exchange with nickel that went up to over $1,000, and then they canceled it, that kind of thing. Everywhere we look, it's been one of the themes of Money Talks. It's just open your imagination. Don't tell me what can't happen because it's about to. And I'm sort of sitting there going, I have trouble getting people to understand this is fundamental. This is changing their financial lives. And some people are going to be roadkill. So I'm going to start by throwing that question to you. How do you get people to pay attention and care about this? Why should they care?
Why should they care? I think you're right. I think there is absolutely a monumental shift happening in the global financial system. And in the global economy, and maybe a better way of putting it is a global marking to market of shifts that have long been underway. And so if you look to, say, for example, China and emerging markets more broadly, in 2013, emerging markets became the majority of global GDP for the first time in almost 300 years. And there was a small article in the Financial Times on the eighth page, and people sort of moved on. And there have been other hints like that. China became the world's biggest oil importer, surpassing the United States a few years back. Small article, people moved on. U.S. debt to GDP surpassed 100% for the first time since the immediate aftermath of World War II. There's been some notice there, more articles, but there's been so much concern about U.S. debt levels for so long that it's almost been a case of the boy who cried wolf. And so there's not been that much concern. There was a period of time in 2005 where there was to 2010, there were concerns about peak oil or peak cheap oil. And U.S. shale came in and helped ameliorate that issue. And now you have some articles in the last year or two that U.S. shale is peaking and that it can't probably produce a lot more than it is. And so I think the reason why there's been the complacency we've seen is there are so many things that are coming together all at once from different angles. And they're each problematic, but not necessarily catastrophic. And it's only when you start layering these things on one after the other where they become catastrophic. So, for example, something we've been talking a lot about is, or potentially catastrophic. So, for example, one of the things we've been talking about is yes, peak cheap energy, where it's not that we're running out of energy, but that energy is increasingly becoming more and more expensive to find sufficient quantities of it. That in and of itself would not be a problem in an equity-based society, in a society that was not massively over-levered. However, energy is ultimately nature's real discount rate. It's the true discount rate of economic activity. And basically every financial asset on the board, including sovereign debt, is effectively priced off of, on the assumption of a continuously growing supply of cheap and affordable energy. And so if the marginal supply of energy gets more and more expensive, the marginal financial asset becomes less and less sustainable. And the problem is once you get debt levels as high as we have, we really can't afford, in the West in particular, but China in certain ways as well, elsewhere around the world, we have levered this system to such an extent by virtue of the serial bailouts for the last 30 years that we can't afford to have even the marginal piece of debt become diseconomic, uneconomic, start to default, because it will touch off. You know, it's like smoking in a nitroglycerin plant. What's the right number of cigarettes to have in a nitroglycerin plant? And the answer is a zero, because if one catches the wrong way, the whole thing, you're not going to be able to stop that chain reaction. And so I think that's why it's so important hard to see, but that once you start seeing it, and the way the interplay of these different factors have a potential of interacting with each other, it's very difficult to unsee it.
And your point about all of these things coming together, at least I feel it, actually. I actually feel it. I've been saying, I haven't felt this busy where I feel 24 hours a day, I have to be watching different markets and different things. There's so much coming at us, and it's all, you know, so much significance. But let's come back to the debt issue there. I mean, to me, that's an overriding context for policy limitations. And one of the things that I think people are more familiar with is the inflation story, i.e. things are more expensive. And the normal response to that is we'll raise interest rates. We've had the Bank of Canada, we've had Europe, we've had Japan, and of course the Federal Reserve saying, yeah, we're going to raise interest rates, but we're going to do a lot of it coming up. I see that's out of the question now. I mean, you've got a slowing economy, you know, thanks to record energy prices. And what, you're going to raise rates into that and make it worse for government who's overextended? I mean, as I say, so many factors. I just don't see that happening.
And that's the thing I think that is, it's not different this time, but it's very different than anything else people have seen in their lifetimes. And what I mean by that is we have not seen a global sovereign debt bubble since, particularly in the developed markets, since the immediate aftermath of World War I. And so we went through this process over the last 20 years. In the U.S., we had an equity bubble. It popped. We kicked it upstairs to the housing sector, to the banking sector via a housing bubble. It popped. We kicked that problem upstairs to the sovereign level via government backstops of basically everything. And so now governments are so overlevered, the symptom of a problem there is inflation. To your point, you've got to tighten rates, but you can't, because you would need to cut U.S. governments, or you cut government spending. And I'm most familiar with the U.S., but when you look at U.S. government spending, U.S. government's 20 to 25% of GDP. So if you cut government spending, you're going to cut GDP, which is going to make the problem worse, not better. If you don't cut rates, inflation's going to get, or raise rates, excuse me, you're going to get inflation worse. And so it has been lost, I think, in the West, because everybody that lived through it after World War I and traded through it obviously is dead. And so the collective consciousness of this is lost. Now, if we went down to Latin America and we described what is happening here, we remember that. You're just describing 1982 through 2002. That was that period of time for us, this rolling series of crises, financial crises, sovereign debt crises, currency crises, high inflation, inability to raise rates enough, et cetera, et cetera. And regrettably, what we're seeing is, I think, in real time, the destruction of a false narrative. So in 2005 in the United States, the narrative was U.S. home prices could never fall nationally. They had never fallen nationally. That was false on both metrics. After the fact, we, of course, learned they could. But U.S. home prices had fallen nationally in the Great Depression. And so there was just, what they were really saying is, we couldn't have a crisis big enough to have that happen again. And of course, that was proven false. In the same way, there is this false narrative in the United States and in the West more broadly that sovereign debt doesn't matter. And everybody believes it because it hasn't mattered in such a long time. But here we are. And so what it ultimately comes down to is, are the sovereigns going to have the discipline to take the pain, slash the spending, raise the rates, and crash their economies and go through the austerity and pain that implies? And quite frankly, that would imply restructuring or defaulting on entitlements and sovereign debt in the West, along with slashing defense spending, which I find highly unlikely for political and economic reasons, or printing the difference, the central banks printing the difference into an inflation. And that really takes you to our two potential paths at this point, which is severe austerity, economic pain, restructuring of basically the entire social contract in social democracies in the West. In other words, for example, in the United States, dear 70 million baby boomers, I know you're used to getting a Social Security check every month. Now it's only going to come every other month. And foreign holders of treasuries, we're only going to send you 2 coupons a year on your interest payments, not 4. That is one option. I think the odds of that happening are extraordinarily slim. I think much more likely is that the Fed is going to come out and under the auspices of we need to make sure the treasury market functions properly or the smooth functioning of credit markets, we are going to actually increase liquidity. I don't think they're going to call it QE because I think they want to try to preserve the last shreds of credibility that is tattering for them. But say, listen, we're going to special treasury functioning facility. And the gist of it is they're going to do more QE into this inflation spike. And inflation's going to keep getting worse. And I think it will. We'll go through a period of 5 years where we see extremely high inflation. It'll be underreported to some extent. And at the end of that period of time, the real, the debt to GDP will be worked down to a level from which these countries can actually raise rates without blowing things up. And it's a time-honored way of doing things. And what it just speaks to is you know, what's normal for the spider is chaos for the fly. And so for bondholders are the flies here. They're going to get eaten by the spider, which is inflation. And so it just is, particularly for people in retirement on fixed incomes, I think you're already starting to see it's becoming critical to have assets that can offset the inflation. I don't think this is temporary. I think they're going to tell you it's temporary the whole time. That's what they do throughout history. So I think it's important to understand the underlying factors driving this quote unquote temporary inflation. Because once we do, we see it's probably not temporary. I mean, everything's temporary, right? In the long enough timeline. I think it's going to last several years.
Well, and again, we look at the energy market situation, which was already showing itself with problems in, you know, in the fall in Europe and in China, you know, and of course it's been exacerbated by the sanctions on Russia or the threatened sanctions, et cetera. But to me, that just means, you know, inflation's with us. I mean, energy is every transporter to every good, let alone the food prices because of fertilizer and all of this kind of stuff. So then it begs the question, okay, I mean, as you said, there are so many things coming at us and sort of you get caught between, I'm oversimplifying, but I want to make sure people have some takeaways here too. And that is what you're describing to me is a very negative for paper currency. And as you've described on Forest for the Trees, people don't get it. We've had a crash in terms of oil. You know, our buying power has crashed. Forget versus the euro. It's crashed versus copper. It's crashed versus nickel. You know, all of those things. That to me is another massive story. Part of how do I protect myself? Because, gosh, if I'm saving at a 2% rate, and I'll just give you an example up in Canada, we had housing prices go up 20%, similar in most urban areas in the States. Well, you know, I hardly want to be saving then, you know, or using that savings vehicle. So let's talk just very quickly on the scenario that inflation that you were just referring to. How do we protect ourselves?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think it's important to reframe the discussion away from the dollar is strong because it's rising against the euro and the yen effectively when you look at something like the DXY index. And instead reframe it as the dollar is falling against things I need to live, shelter, food, housing, energy, education at a very rapid clip. And so I think it ultimately is about understanding A, that this is happening, and then B, understanding that this is not like the last 40 years where, well, the government is going to come in and save me from losing a lot of my purchasing power because they're going to raise rates to contain inflation. The government's balance sheet is in a position they cannot do so. The government is not going to cut themselves off by raising rates. This is an emerging market type playbook. They are going to print the money so that the government can keep spending, purchasing power be damned. And so it becomes really critical to own assets that over time will hedge that depreciation of the currency against things you own. And so those types of things are commodities, industrial related assets, certain, I think, finite residential real estate, certain other finite commodity related properties, farmland, things like that, gold, I think Bitcoin, I would say certain types of tech equities, like the Microsofts and the Googles of the world. I mean, basically, if you buy Microsoft, you buy Google, you're buying the American government. You're the people that are going to be printing the money for themselves. So I think that, you know, it's not like Google's going to get cut off for lack of money from the U.S. government. Their contract's going to keep getting paid. So those types of tech names where there's a good, strong free cash flow dynamic to the business. But these are the types of assets you're going to want to have. And overweighting too, because I know a lot of the lives, particularly again for people on a fixed income, they tend to have these lifestyle or these life cycle models that are based on the last 40 years, which in all reality, the last 40 years are extraordinarily peaceful, non-volatile, non-inflationary. And right, so they're all a lot of some version of 60-40 equities, fixed income, adjusted for your age. And the older you get, the more fixed income you should have. And what we're describing here is we should be upgrading the risk of currency depreciation, upgrading the inflation risk on the fixed income side of the portfolio, and really try to think more in terms of real purchasing power. And so what that means in practical terms is just whatever percentage you have in these inflation hedge type assets, per the life cycle model, you probably should be a bit heavier than that, and a bit lower than that, than what the life cycle model says for fixed income, because it just, you're not getting paid to hedge those inflation risks.
It seems a rock and a hard place again when you look at, okay, I own a bond, and if the government's going to manipulate or continue to manipulate interest rates down, or, you know, I know they ended the quantitative easing in the States this past week. Canada was about, off the top of my head, 5 months earlier. That's what kept interest rates down. So they're stepping away, but I'm going to see them forced to step back in, because who the heck wants to buy looking at like a 10-year at under 2%, you know, when I know inflation. I don't have to have the government tell me what inflation is. I went to the grocery store. I went to the gas pump. As you say, I watched my rent, or I watched the purchasing power on in terms of a hard asset like a home. You know, to me, I don't even know who's owning these things now, because it makes so little sense. And so it's going to be forcing the Federal Reserve and Central Bank of Canada and others to step back in and be the main owner. I mean, this is why I say it's a fundamental shift in the economy or the financial system.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think ultimately that's going to be, to me, the big aha moment or oh crap moment coming for a lot of investors in the West in particular, in these developed markets, is the realization that, yes, absolutely, central banks can print money into an inflation spike. And they will, because of the sovereign, and really it's just sovereign debt actually matters. It doesn't matter for long, long stretches. And then it's all that matters. And we're in that part of the economic cycle that happens with roughly once every 80 to 100 years, where all that matters is the sovereign debt. And so in order to keep the sovereign debt nominally solvent, they're going to have to keep printing money to keep interest rates artificially low, keep real interest rates significantly negative. And significantly negative real interest rates is a really good environment for commodities, gold, real estate, hard assets, not, and a really bad environment for bonds.
And again, I don't want to talk sort of my own theme here, but we've been calling it a monetary crisis, saying it started, you know, late last year in, and it's part of what I referred to is our money doesn't buy much. Yeah, I can buy Japanese yen, but I can't eat it. But I need food, I need energy, I need housing. And I'm seeing this, and the scenario you're describing, I see just the dismantling of purchasing power. And so I'm just trying to, again, implore people, pay attention to what Luke's saying. You've got to make a shift, because you're going to wake up. And one of the things I've noticed in the market, Luke, is once something starts moving, once it becomes on the radar, it's so abrupt, it's so fast. It's not some sort of incremental shift here. And I see that, by the way, with, you know, we've seen, you know, Bitcoin isn't quite there in terms of, you know, finding the equilibrium on a daily basis, you know, but, you know, and gold's looking for that. But when you measure it against every other commodity, I'm just back to, please pay attention.
I think that's right. It does. You've seen these, they little by little and then all at once. And I think that we're seeing that all at once in various situations. And unfortunately, I think we're going to see it more frequently in a number of different markets in coming weeks, months, and quarters.
Let me shift gears just for a second and come to a couple of actions that we've seen from government. It started in Canada when the federal government decided to freeze assets of people or bank accounts of people who donated to a legal protest. And now we find out that it was exactly as the protest presented and not what the government. It was not foreign funded. It was 88% Canadian funded with small amounts. So clearly it was populist in that notion. But for me, it was, oh my gosh, 15 minutes later, we froze the assets of Russian oligarchs. We froze. I mean, this is what will shock people. We froze central bank assets of Russia. I think that is also profound if I'm talking, and I know this is getting into sort of deep water, but the dominance of the US dollar, when we politicize these kinds of things, again, big stuff is happening out there.
I agree. I think ultimately what we just saw, I think in particular that freezing of the central bank's FX reserves, I think we will look back in time, whether that's a year, 2 years, 5 years, I think we're going to look back in time with and see that as every bit as important as when President Nixon closed the gold window in 1971. I wrote this week that what the United States did by freezing Russian central bank FX reserves was that the United States closed the FX reserves window. And so they are going to, I think you've got $12 trillion in global FX reserves. People say, well, Russia's a bad actor. It's only for bad actors. Well, if you go back over the last 80 years, the list of countries that the United States has never considered a bad actor at some point in time is exceedingly short. Japan was a bad actor in the 80s. France was a bad actor in the 60s and 70s. Britain was a bad actor in the 50s. And those are our best friends. The Germans were bad actors at times in the 60s, 70s. We're talking post-war era. We're not even getting into the last 100 years where obviously there were more adversarial relationships. So the point here is that I think what we just did completely changed the mindset at the supranational sovereign bank level regarding the stockpiling of FX reserves, and this has as rainy day assets. And so I think you're going to see $12 trillion in FX reserves bid for physical gold over time. And there's only $12 trillion of physical gold that was ever mined. So it's pretty bullish for gold, I think.
You've got to exactly what you anticipated my next question, because I'm saying, you know, one of the things I've noticed when we say we're going to put this sanction on, we're going to exclude them from the SWIFT system. Fair enough. I'm not debating that. I'm just saying what I have a problem with is no one seems to be looking at what will be the consequences of that. What, I mean, you think Russia is not going to do something? You think China is not going to do something? Observing exactly what you've outlined, when you become a political enemy, you're in play. Your money's in play. And so it is interesting. I saw that as a driver of gold prices. I mean, or where else are they putting their money? You know, if you're Russia, maybe you put it somewhat reserves in China. You know, I don't know. You know, I watch their bonds outperform U.S. bonds. So maybe that's the case. But something's going to transpire. That's why I thought, Ella, what you said, it was a monumental move. They are going to respond. And maybe digital currencies like Bitcoin become a beneficiary if government would leave them alone. And maybe they won't. Or gold or what have you. But it's monumental, I think.
I agree. And there's this blowback that we can never quite prepare for, right? So a perfect example of this is if you go back to 1993, there's articles from the UK media. I think it's the UK Independent. I mean, it's a fairly large paper there. And there's an article by a reporter named Robert Fisk, who I think ended up winning the Pulitzer, not for this article, but for his other work, at least was nominated. At any rate, the title of the article is Anti-Soviet Warrior Puts His Army on the Path to Peace. And the picture in the article of the man was someone Americans would come to know very, very well a few years later. It was Osama bin Laden. So in 1993, we have this anti-Soviet warrior that was this noble, heroic Mujahideen fighting the Soviets, and he had won, and hurrah, we had you know, sent them Stinger missiles and these heroic Mujahideen. And 8 years later, look what happened. And so there's these, it's this boomerang effect, this blowback effect, sometimes on a pretty pronounced lag, but they have a way of getting, of magnifying by the time they blow back at you. And so for me, I think the Trudeau situation is exactly that. I think, and this seizure of central bank reserves of foreign private assets. And let's simplify it. What's the value of Apple stock if the Chinese say we're seizing the Apple factories in China? What's the value of Cupertino residential real estate, Cupertino, California residential real estate, if the Chinese seize the Apple factories and the and Apple stock crashes? There's got to be a lot of Cupertino residential real estate that's effectively collateralized by Apple options, Apple incentive stock that would become worth a lot less. And you can just see how exquisitely and finely linked all of this is. And you can't just pull out these, you can't start doing these things without blowback. Now, I'm not saying I think Apple stock is short. I'm not thinking the Chinese will do this. What I do think is there's virtually no thinking on these types of second and third tier levels being done by the policymakers as they implement these smash and grabs or these weaponizations of finance. When you live in the biggest glass house of them all, it's ill-advised to start throwing stones.
That's a wonderful, again, bringing people to their attention, how intertwined it is. And I mean, it's not like we don't have precedent. Look what the Russian government or the Russian leading party this past week got passed that resolution that they could confiscate the assets of any American company that had left. Or now they've said you can't exchange rubles for foreign currency within the country. I mean, it's one of those governments can do anything statements, let alone freezing the bank accounts. That should have been enough evidence for everyone. But I'm looking at the Chinese tech stocks taking a dive finally, you know, a significant dive, you know, so I think the most since October 2008. And I'm going, okay, they're sort of worried about the stuff Luke just described, and rightly so. And it shows how intertwined. Now, I know I've kept you longer than we said, but it's fascinating and why I think people should go to Forest for the Trees, why you should go to YouTube. And I say, just type in Luke's name, Luke Grohman. It's Forest for the Trees. I'm going to give the website address, FFTT-LLC.com. I'll put it up on all our social media. We'll send it out there so you don't have to memorize that, but you should do it. Luke, let's finish with sort of summing up here. And again, everyone's got their own financial circumstances and attitude and emotions. I get that. But I'm just sort of saying, I don't want to own bonds. Let me start with that. I don't want to get paid 2%. And I was early on that, made that very clear to our audience, boy, back in February of 2020, saying one more kick at the can in the bond market, then I'm out of there. Risk reward doesn't work. I want to make sure that I have a position, and this is me saying, and I want you to contradict me. I'm saying from in gold, you know, Bitcoin is in play, other assets that will protect me from this blatant decline in purchasing power with inflation going to be with us. And, you know, as I say, my goal is to protect people. I love your point. I hadn't considered it about Microsoft. You know, it's going to be fueled by the U.S. federal government as an example. So that's pretty much safe. So, and an inflationary environment with us for who knows when.
I think that's right. I think it's important for people with, I think we're going to be in this inflationary environment. And then I think it's important to start factoring in these regulatory risks we all now run. And so I think there are politically acceptable inflation hedges and there are politically unacceptable inflation hedges. And what I mean by that is I think two of the best inflation hedges will be gold and Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin is going to continue to be extraordinarily volatile. And so I think it's important to understand that. With that said, myself personally, I would not put more into Bitcoin than one would be willing to have the government lock up in cold storage for a decade, right? So you don't want to have too much. Similarly, gold. Gold was illegal to own in the United States for 40 years, from 1933 to 74. And so, again, I don't think that that is not my base case. It's private property now, that net versus being currency back then. And so it is different. With that said, these are politically unacceptable hedges. And so I think you want to be as big as you can comfortably be in those, but you don't want to be 50, 60, 80, 100% in these things, because there's a significant, now we see, non-zero chance that governments can come out and say, it's illegal to own this stuff. And now, it's not that I don't think they're going to come door to door looking for it, but you're not going to be able to take it to a bank. You're not going to be able to monetize a lot of it in anything but a black market. That's not a great situation to be in. The flip side is what I would call politically acceptable inflation hedges. Residential real estate, particularly attractive pieces of property on that are finite, on lakes and great mountain views, you know, out west by you, things like that that make them unique, finite, good inflation hedges. Equities, like we talked about, particularly those of an industrial commodity bent, some of the tech bent. I think I would much rather own, when you think about bonds, I would much rather own Clorox, Procter & Gamble, some of these consumer durable type staples names that are going to have a coupon to them or a dividend to them. And again, are more finite than the treasury issuance, than we're likely to see. And the stock itself can rise in price significantly. Whereas from here, treasury bond prices, sovereign debt prices more broadly around the world are going to be very hard pressed to rise significantly, because rates can really only not, they can't get that negative. So I think it's really, and then lastly, I think it is important. I am personally running with a bigger than usual cash position. And I think it is important in these times to understand that there is a scenario where we do go through some period of austerity, or we do go through some period of supply chain breakdown. It's not like supply chains were functioning really well when we went into this whole last 2 weeks. And so I think it's, as a volatility hedge, austerity hedge, things go pear-shaped hedge, to I think have more cash. That's not to say physical cash in a safe, although you may want some of that too. I'm just talking about within your portfolio having I'm running with a bigger than usual cash position, simply as a hedge of the volatility that I think we're likely going to continue to see, and then also just giving me that optionality. I think the end game is very sustained high inflation, a sustained very high inflation. But if there's deflation first, that gives me the optionality of saying, okay, great, I can do this, that, and the other, and then go from there. So that's how I would answer that.
Get a sense of why I respect Luke Grohman's research to the degree I do. I know, you know, I'm old. I've been around. You know, I've had the pleasure of talking to lots of people, and it is a pleasure to pick the brains of people who do nothing but think at a higher level about the things that are impacting all of us. And no environment is going to impact us more than I think the one we're in right now, as described by Luke. So again, I want to say, go to YouTube, just click on Luke Grohman, Forest for the Trees. He does five, it might be 10 minutes, whatever. He does some Q&A every week, gives you a sample of what they get at Forest for the Trees. And again, that website address is FFTT, Forest for the Trees, straightforward, -LLC.com, forestforthetrees.com. Luke, can't thank you enough. And I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm going to put a big red letter to be continued. We've got to talk again soon. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on. It was great talking, Michael.